It's Tuesday, June 30th, 2015, and welcome to episode 178 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
I'm Brian Poulter.
Welcome to Tech Talk for Teachers, the podcast about teaching and learning. So this time we're going to have a special project. We've got a special guest here with us today, Brian Poulter from our journalism department. Welcome, Brian.
Hello.
And Brian's going to give us an overview. He's doing a project called...
Fair People of Illinois.
Fair People of Illinois. So we want to make sure that we put a link in the show notes for that. Be sure to check out Brian's project. But Brian is a photojournalist here at EIU, and he's going around to several of the county fairs this summer and just kind of doing an overview of...
I'm photographing portraits of the people I meet, you know, everything from people who work at the carnival to debutantes.
Okay. And there's quite a few county fairs going on. So Brian's going to be very, very busy here in the next couple of months. So we'll put a link. And then Cindy, you and I think we'll talk a little bit, and Brian as well. Our technology picks of the week coming up.
That's right. Some different applications. We're all about the visual today, apparently, because all of our tech picks have to do with how we're taking information through the images that we see.
Okay, so sit back, relax, and enjoy. And here we go. With us today is Brian Poulter from our journalism department here at Eastern Illinois University, and I've invited Brian in today to talk a little bit more about a special project he's working on this summer, and I believe called it Fair People of Illinois.
That's correct.
So can you just give just a little bit of a brief introduction about the project and why you decided to take it on this summer?
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things most the faculty here at Eastern tries to do is keep on top of their subject matter. And one of the ways I'm doing that is I decided to do this project where I just take portraits of people at the various county fairs throughout Illinois. And Verizon's always been really nice to me, so I asked them for a grant, and they're giving me an iPad for the summer and cell phone connectivity for it, so I can do a lot of the photography, these portraits in the field, and work and edit them on an iPad and then transmit them back to my website.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worked really, really well. Verizon's network covers a lot of very weird corners in the state of Illinois, I found out.
Yeah. And we should probably back up just a little bit. In journalism, your specialty and things is photojournalism.
Photojournalism, and I help support the new media concentration as well. So, you know, photography and last 15 years, digital photography and new media and the internet. It's just, you know, it's changing every single week. And
right.
You gotta stay on top of it.
Yeah. Like many subject areas, technology's having an impact, you know, no matter what your subject matter is. So.
Well, and it's very cool because we're talking about what you're doing today and what a lot of the images and that are in the Library of Congress, the historic ones, those are the types of things that we're encouraging students to learn with and use. Those primary sources that are of real people in real life, not the staged national events, but what's really happening.
Right. And you and
in our communities.
Yeah. And you and I have had conversations before about photojournalism versus more, I don't know what you would call it, but I'm kind of more of a hobbyist photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So I like changing different filters and things like that. But in photojournalism, you're looking for that photorealistic. So
right.
There's a philosophy difference there whenever you approach it from a journalism perspective.
People ask me all the time, you know, how do you teach ethics when it comes to photojournalism? And it's actually not that big of a mystery. The question you ask yourself is this what you saw? Are you doing something that changes reality? Are you taking something in or out of the photograph? You started applying a bunch of filters. That's not what it looked like when you're standing there. And so you're just trying to be accurate to what your eye saw. And so people try to get way too tricky about what's ethical. Is this what you saw?
Right.
Is that what you photographed?
Right. And then with Library of Congress and primary sources, and whenever digital photography, you know, was introduced, you know, decade two ago, I mean, it's gradually been happening over the last couple of decades. And, you know, finally the digital has, you know, I remember when they said digital would never surpass film, you know, and the quality and things, and we're there now.
And, you know, and going back to what you said in terms of the Library of Congress and history and our visual memory, as I call it, a lot of the photographs that are historically important were not made by quote-unquote professionals.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why people need to be out and covering their towns. And that's sort of the point of this is county fairs aren't well covered. Mm-hmm. But that's part of Americana. And in 10, 20, 50, 100 years, we're going to look back at those photographs, and that's what we're going to have right. to show us what things look like. Right. So everybody has a potential to be a historian, in a way, a visual historian. And this may be a subject for another day, but one of the things people really need to think about now is how are they archiving their personal collection of these photographs that may be historically significant. Mm-hmm. CDs are not archival. Your hard drive is going to fail. We've all had that happen to us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Google has just came out with a system where they'll back up all your photography for you. I don't use that because I don't want them using the data and trying to figure out where I was and who I was and all that sort of stuff. But there's other competitors that are free, like Flickr. I have a Amazon Prime account, which I pay for, but that also provides unlimited backup. And I'm shooting in what's called a RAW format, so my files are huge, but they don't seem to care that I'm putting massive amounts of data. And the fact that I'm paying for it, I'm a little bit more confident they're not going to take it away from me. But whatever solution you come up with, just throwing them on Facebook is not archival.
Right.
You're the product on Facebook, and they can take away all that because they're giving it to you free, and overnight they can say, oh, we decided to close Facebook, or we decided not to back up your work for you.
Right. But it's interesting over the years because I came into photography, actually taught in high school a darkroom class. People remember what's
as
a darkroom.
I did too.
But, you know, we've gone from that period where we took very, very few photographs. So I remember back then we took a lot of time and effort, composition and things, and we had to develop this film, which was an additional cost and things. And now then it's just kind of the opposite. We just take 1,000 pictures and nobody looks at anything. So we're kind of gone from this scarcity model to this overabundance. And, you know, and then that leads to the storage and the archival and things, things that we deal with all the time, whether it's photography or student work of any type, an e-portfolio or whatever it might be. And also, over the years, with the change taking on this county fair project, I think there's 102 counties in Illinois.
That's correct.
You're not doing all of them, are you?
No. Well, actually, luckily, not every single county has a county fair, but most of them do. But the state of Illinois has conspired by saying, we're going to have a county fair at this far corner of the state and this far corner of the state and this far corner of the state exactly the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is essentially self-funded. It's something I just want to do, so there's the limit of my pocketbook, but I'm trying to be geographically representative and go to the corners of the state. And right now I'm luckily in my backyard because for whatever reason, a whole bunch of the counties in this area are having their fairs now, but most are in July and then later in August and into September.
Yeah, June, July, August are definitely.
And we officially have 2 state fairs in the state, which it confuses me to this day. So, there's more than enough fair to go around.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Because I grew up right near DuCoin.
Exactly.
So that was the state fair that I was always referred to. And then whenever I found out there was also one in Springfield, I was like, huh, okay.
And there's actually some counties that sort of have 2 county fairs. Like, they have one official one, but Clark County essentially has 2 county fairs, and they're wonderful, so I'm not in any way saying that's a bad thing, but, and then there's festivals.
Right.
So there's more than enough stuff. If you want to eat a lot of corn dogs, you have an opportunity in this state.
Funnel cakes.
Well, and just,
Deep fried Snicker bars.
Yes.
And the reason for the county fairs to begin with the evolution, were tied to our agricultural roots here in Illinois. And I mean, that's was tied to the summer. And then also 4-H projects, which started at the turn of last century. So they've been going on for a number of years. But it's, for a local community, if you stop and think, before the automobile, it's when the county fairs and things started, everything was local. So you were within, a day's horseback ride of everything. And it was a really big deal. That was your entertainment.
Oh, it was the social event for many communities.
Yeah.
And we wish we would have had more photographs from those.
Absolutely.
And for a lot of these communities, despite the fact that they have all these other distractions and other things people can be doing, they choose. This is still a significant choice for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great way to socialize, and it's just something nice about that nice summer light as a photographer and how warm it is. And, it is still fun to go to these events.
Yeah, well, I have many fond memories growing up as a kid going through. And another thing, I'm sure there's collections. I remember seeing the big posters, posted all over town, and I'm sure people collect those things. But talk about preserving the histories and just the graphical art and things over the years, the way it evolved, the lithograph. You know, a lot of time, like I said, this was a big social event, so a lot of time and effort and promotion went into these things. And then, you know, here in this immediate area, horse racing's a big draw and things at the mm-hmm. at the county fairs. And as I said, the 4-H with the right. youth, you know, mom and dad and grandparents and cousins and everybody, you know,
absolutely,
you know, showing off their livestock and their crops and things. So you've been out going recently, I think, a local one.
Pyatt, Vermilion, Clark, Sagamon. I'm missing one in there. And I've already learned, I got to talk to a guy for a couple hours about his brown Swiss cows, and I know a lot about steam engines, mm-hmm. and I know a lot now about 1929 taffy pulling machines mm-hmm. and trotters mm-hmm. and how horse trotter or buggy racing is bigger in Indiana than it is in Illinois, and ironically, it's dying in Kentucky. We think that's a horse state, but that's no mm-hmm. people want to, it's a better setup in Indiana, and it's amazing if you just stop and talk to people. Which I like to do. How much you can learn about a bunch of things you didn't even know you had an interest in until you started talking to
people. Oh, absolutely. We're talking, you know, world-class people that are very passionate into the hobby or whatever it might be.
Well, and you also have festivals that may reflect what's going on in the culture of the community now and sometimes even something that's long gone from their past. Well,
Houston has, you know, they're big on corn.
Sweet Corn right. Festival.
Broom
corn
festivals. Yeah. And,
Arcola has a broom corn, which, you know, that's another
popcorn
dying.
Festival. I know down at home, either Hoyleman or Hoffman, one of them had the Hofbräufest because originally it was a very German community.
When I grew up in Wisconsin, and I worked for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. That's Eau Claire's up by Minneapolis. And I interned there, and I remember, as an intern, they sent me to the Boyceville Cucumber Festival. If you know where Boyceville, Wisconsin is, I don't know why. But I went there a couple years, and they would make fun. And when I ended up working there for a while, they would just keep sending me there because they thought it was funny. Well, they didn't know that I enjoyed going to that festival.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that's where they grow cucumbers there. That's part of the
national. Oh, there's so much to cover. Yeah. And then I don't know if you're specifically, you know, probably just doing the general coverage and things, but within each kind of county fair, there's usually a structure. You know, we'll have a tractor pulling night,
mm-hmm.
and that's big again, rural Illinois.
Beauty contest.
Shot last night. Shot
church night.
Mm-hmm. Maybe yeah. Republican night, Democrat night.
Yeah.
The other thing to think about, too, and going back to photography for a second, is so you take these photographs, and one of the things I try to do, and this is journalistic training, but get a quote from the person in the photograph. When I'm working in Photoshop, the software program, you can hit file info, and you can embed that information, the caption, into the photograph.
The
you don't know how many times I've been at my grandparents' house, and they'll show me a picture, and I'll flip it over, and it will say who it was and the year it was and how valuable that is.
Yes.
Or the old Kodak prints used to put a date on the edge of the print.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, ironically, one of the pictures I use for the little website I have for this so people can look at the work, a little about me section. It's a photograph from me when I'm 5. I don't want people to know what I look like today. I'll scare them. And it says, you know, the date on it, that then I know exactly how old I am on this photograph because mm-hmm. it's printed on the photograph.
Yeah, so yeah. valuable.
And I'm on a motorcycle in this photograph, and nobody in my family at this point ever owned a motorcycle. That's one of the great family mysteries, is whose motorcycle is that? Someone needed to write on the back of that photograph, context, mm-hmm. date, mm-hmm. what was going on, because the photographs by themselves are very, very interesting, but without a historical context of date, place, time, who, what, when, where,
right.
and why, they lose a lot of their value. So as you save your photographs, figure out a mechanism.
Are you doing that? Are you putting the metadata in there?
It's in there, and I have my Photoshop and such setup, so some of that's naturally embedded. It puts date and GPS data into some of
so
them.
So you can kind of do it in a batch mode, because it'd be overwhelming, you know.
Well, my camera does it. It puts mm-hmm. GPS coordinates into
right,
it,
yeah.
And the software always puts a copyright embed in mine, mm-hmm. and that sort of stuff.
But, I mean, could you say, you know, this is the, you know, the Clark County Fair or something, and then batch all those photos together? Or,
not without
let's talk a little
some
bit about
plugins.
Process.
There's a program that most of my photojournalist students use who work professionally called Photo Mechanic. And that allows them to, like, write a sentence and then say, put this in every single photograph of these 100 that I'm batching. So mm-hmm. at least you know it's from mm-hmm. the Clark County Fair or mm-hmm. whatever county fair you're talking about. And they can actually batch edit. You can mm-hmm. do things like color or basic sharpening. There's all kinds of batch things. And in Photoshop, you can do this. It just takes a... You'll probably have to Google a tutorial on how to do it. It's not hard. You just have to decide that you want to do it and figure out how to do it.
But. Right. Well, it's time consuming. It's organization, and it's making yourself do it and doing it consistently. You know, those are just challenges. You know, there's things that we always say that we want to do. It's just finding the time and, you know, having that workflow, that work process to do it. You mentioned that you started this project to update and keep your skills up to date and explore some new technologies. So what type of cameras are you concentrating on using, and how does that tie to your curriculum whenever you teach our students here at EIU, you know, photojournalism?
Well, my past projects, I have used some point-and-shoot cameras to shoot some projects that I had, you know, professional quality work that I had published and whatnot. And I've shot with cell phones. And this year I'm shooting with a series of cameras made by Fujifilm, which is ironic since they hardly make any film anymore. But they're the people that make a lot of the high-end lenses that you'll see in TV cameras and that. They've been making optics for a long time. And these cameras use what's called a 5/3 sensor, which is a little bit smaller than what you would find in a digital SLR. But they're high-end sensors, and they allow the cameras to be a lot smaller. Portability is always a great thing. Smaller cameras don't intimidate people. The lenses become a little smaller because of that. They probably only cost about 60 to 70% of what a comparable, which you would consider a professional DSLR camera, would cost. And they're sort of known as the poor man's Leica. The lenses are so exceptionally sharp, and they produce such exceptionally crisp photographs that I just love working with the cameras. And again, when you're at county fairs, you don't want to intimidate people because you're pulling out this huge monstrosity of the camera. It ruins the moment. When you have a smaller camera, people just kind of like ignore you, which is the best thing that can ever happen as a photojournalist. So the 5/3 format cameras are really interesting. Fujifilm makes some. Sony's making a lot. Canon's trying to play a little bit of catch up. Nikon, of course, is, but I think Sony, Panasonic, and Fujifilm are the ones that sort of jumped on this format, and it's something really interesting. I've shot Canon, I've shot Nikon, and for what I'm shooting right now, this format and these cameras are my favorite. If I was shooting sports action exclusively or predominantly, I'd probably go to a different approach.
Well, you'd need a telephoto zoom and things like that too, and I have faster shutter speeds.
Well, and nice thing too about these cameras is they are what we call fast lenses. They're technical f-stops of 1.2 and 1.0 and 1.8. In other words, they don't need a lot of light, which is, again, ideal for, you know, late in the afternoon or early evening on a midway of a fair when the light's twilight. I mean, they're just really nice lenses and cameras for that. So it's a different approach and a different format than what I've worked with traditionally.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be sure to put a link in the show notes. Can you go ahead and I don't know what the link is.
It's fairil.com. You know, F-A-I-R, like county fair. Just I added I-L like Illinois. Fairil.com.
My technology pick of the week this week is a book creator app that's been available for Android and iTunes for some while now, but the actual name of the app is Book Creator, and it's probably geared a little bit more toward elementary, maybe middle school, but it's just a very simple way to put together an electronic book, and if you so choose, I think you can post them out in iTunes. But it's available now in the Windows Store, so it's one of those cross-platform apps, and it's very popular out there in the school, so I just want to bring that up and mention that. And then the other thing that kind of hit my radar the last month or so, with Windows 10 and things starting to come out, they're starting to release some new hardware, and I don't know if you've seen, they're called stick PCs, but it's essentially, you know, a PC on this little, it looks like a USB drive, flash drive, but they're plugging them into the back of HDMI monitors, and I'm starting to see a lot of them, you know, under, sometimes well under $200. But, you know, for photography and things, a lot of places are starting to use these things, you know, where they have a TV display in the lobby or something, or at your home, or like business people will take them with them and they can plug it into the back of a TV in a hotel room or something like that.
Presentations for like kiosks and such.
PowerPoint, you know, it's continuous rolling and things, or just a continuous slideshow of photographs or whatever. You know, they have Wi-Fi built into them. So typically 32 gigabytes is what I've been seeing on storage, which is considerable. But then you also have access to tie to a Flickr account or a OneDrive account or, you know, whatever it might be out there in the cloud. So interesting development as this technology miniaturizes and as it becomes more and more affordable. And schools in this immediate area with the one-to-one programs and a lot of Chromebooks and things coming in. Mm-hmm. I mean, our children today essentially just are immersed in these digital technologies. So those are my tech picks.
So, very cool.
Sandy, what do you have?
Well, mine, I was in the content literacy course I was teaching, we were discussing infographics and how to use those not only to give information, but having students create infographics to show understanding and share information that they have, and how the process of creating an infographic, you really have to know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. If you're going to create one that makes sense. And then picking out those highlights and what's going to get the response. And so when I was looking for examples, I found a site, it's elearninginfographics.com, and they've just got some really good examples of different infographics that are out there. But I'm just, you know, having a lot of fun using these infographics as a teaching tool, and just, you know, with another way for students to present what they've learned beyond just writing a report or giving a simple presentation. And that one thing I did find, the students were mad. I made them draw them and write them on chart paper. They were mad. They wanted to use a computer to make it cool. But I explained to them that then they would have spent a quarter of the time on the information and three quarters on the time making it of their time making it cool.
Right.
And it wasn't about that at this point. That could be when they're doing this with their future students. Remember that. Sometimes it was just like when PowerPoint first came out and people would put every animation and every sound effect in, and you completely lose, you know,
the substance.
Right. And so, but we really talked about how students need to be able to identify main ideas. And then, you know, the whole thing with Common Core and that is finding evidence to support and all that thing. And so we really use this infographic exercise to do those kinds of things. And it was cool. It was fun.
And from a pedagogy standpoint, you know, the summarizing of the data and things and making it concise, that's always a challenging thing. And the more you know, I can't remember who said it, but, you know, if you can't explain in a sentence, you really don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. You know, you have to make that concise and things. And that's hard to do whenever you're processing all that. And especially, you know, for first-time learners out there on new subject matter.
Well, and also that, an infographic is intended to be a hook. Mm-hmm. And to draw people in. It's not intended to be the one-stop.
Yeah, you see them in newspapers all the time.
Well, infographics, we talk about that all the time. You can get whole concentrations in that. But, you know, there's a sort of a saying, too, in journalism, which is, because journalists are educators. We're trying to get information and educate them. And the saying we like to fall back on is just don't tell, show. You know, it goes back to kindergarten. Show and tell. If you just tell, you're going to lose people. But if you show people, then they're interested in what you have to say. And you can't be a good journalist, and I don't think you'd be a good teacher if you don't show people things.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, Brian, what's your tech pick?
Mine is a program that I absolutely love called Snapseed. It's a piece of software that Google, of course, is now bought and owned. It originally started out by a company called Nik, N-I-K Software. They produced high-end Photoshop plugins. And it's basically Photoshop for mobile devices. It's free, which was always a big thing. And during my other projects working with mobile devices to do photography, I bought probably 28 other apps. Mm-hmm. I don't use any of them here. I use Snapseed. It's how I process, edit, including some of the photographs that I'm working on right now. It's available on iPhone, Android. You were telling me you can run it as an emulator.
It looks like you can run an Android emulator.
If you want to edit your photographs on your phone or on your iPad or Android or whatever, get it. It's free, and it's one of my favorite programs. In fact, it does some things photographically better than Photoshop does. I wish Photoshop would steal some of their ideas. It's just
so
marvelous.
So like these county fair pictures that you're taking, what would be some of the things that you do with it?
I shoot the photograph. I can either transmit it from my camera directly into the iPad or do it via media card transfer. I can crop, I can adjust levels, I can pick out a special part of the photographs and lighten or darken, just like we were doing since the board. Burning and dodging is what we call it. Mm-hmm. They have a bunch of filters. If you care to apply those, HDR, you can convert to black and white. You can make things dreamy. You can put fake old negative type frames like we used to have on film.
Does it do layers too?
No. Well, it doesn't do layers, but it allows you to work in steps and to undo and to do steps before you decide if you want to do them. So it has the functionality of layers, which is to separate operations from each other. And if you get to the end and you don't like it, you can say, okay, I want to start over again. And then you can also save different versions of it.
So whenever you save, where are you saving to?
You can overwrite the file that that you pull it from, or
so save the originals,
or you can save a copy, which is how I prefer to do it, of course. You know, leave the original sacred and make copies of it.
Right.
So it's a very nice piece of software. It's my favorite photo app there is.
I'll download that as soon as the show's over.
Well, I just did while we were talking and pulled it up, and it's very cool.
And there's a ton of tutorials online, but really, just play with it. You'll figure it out.
I'm excited.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That wraps it up for episode 178 of Tech Talk for Teachers. Show notes for this episode and archived episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. To leave a comment or suggestion, please send an email to techtalk@eiu.edu or leave a comment on the Tech Talk for Teachers blog. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
And I'm Brian Poulter.
Keep on learning.